Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Hopefully you can hear me clearly. Unless, is this better? Is that better? Or does this sound okay right here? Either way, David always tells me I need to have my podcast microphone right here so that I can sound like Delilah on the radio station. He's like literally singing Delilah. Okay, we're not gonna have it right there. Why? Because I use my hands a lot when I talk and I will hit this all the time. So it has to be moved back. Okay, welcome. Hello. Okay. When I was hitting it, I hit the mute button. This is why we don't have the microphone close to us. Who's nervous? Anybody nervous? Yeah, a few. Danielle's nervous. Both Danielles are nervous. Nicole's a little nervous. Okay, that's all right. I can handle nervous. Who's like more excited than nervous? Anybody more excited than nervous? Okay, Nicole too. Sinead. Yes. Okay. Amazing. Awesome. Well, however you showed up tonight, I'm grateful you're here. Welcome to this cohort of Feel Without Fear. If I had like a bell, or I should get a bell or something to like ring to make it official. As you guys know, I am Lindsay, and the very handsome gentleman in the chat is my husband slash business partner slash customer service person slash tech nerd. He will be manning the chat this evening. So if you have a question related to the technology or a resource or a website issue, a payment issue, anything like that, David is your person to talk to. I do not handle any of those things. So please, if you don't do it in the chat, you can email support@lindsaylockett.com. That is the best way to get help from us. I don't run any of this from my phone. So if you DM me on Instagram, I have to like take a screenshot and send it to David anyway. And then you have to email him anyway. So just email support. If you have any kind of payment, tech, website, replay issue, questions that are for me. Please do not post those in the chat while I am teaching, because I am not looking at the chat while I'm teaching. I will be looking at a second screen over here. So I will have slides that I'll be teaching from this evening. The slides will be included in your replay. If you are watching tonight from your phone, the slides may be a little bit small. Some of them I have big letters on them and they're really, really easy to read on a phone. And other slides, the letters are smaller and they might be a lot harder to read on a phone. So if you are able to transition to a tablet or a laptop, or to AirPlay your phone to your TV to make it bigger, that will improve your experience of being able to see the slides. I also do slides because if you want to just stay totally present and not worry about taking notes, then you can just like put your pen down and receive. And I literally, the slides are my teaching notes. So you're not going to get anything that I'm not giving you by needing to write it down. You can always watch the replay. So you can take notes if that helps you. Feel free to do that. But if you'd rather just be like totally present to receive, then you'll get the slideshow. The replay is usually available within 48 hours. The only exception to that is that we are entering into the very busy season of our homestead year. We are in the middle of harvesting from the garden, getting all the outdoor projects completed before winter hits. Stacking firewood, doing all of those kinds of things. And sometimes we get carried away on one of those projects and we totally forget or don't have time to get the replay to you. So if for whatever reason a replay does not come within 48 hours, just know it's because, yes, we live in northern Minnesota and we live on 5 acres. We have animals and a garden and all the things. We heat our house with wood. So we have a lot of outdoor things that we have to do to get ready for winter. And this is the time of year that we start doing that in. So, thank you for your patience if we are a little slow in getting a replay out. If you noticed on the website, the times that we're doing our workshops and group calls kind of changed in the middle of the launch. And normally, to keep things really simple for me as well as for you, I would have all of the workshops at a consistent time and all of the group coaching calls at a different consistent time. But because I am ever trying to be more creative in making my work as accessible to people overseas as possible, this cohort, I've decided to change things up a little bit and it's not at a consistent time. And that's so that our friends over in Europe or Asia or Africa or Australia can join us at least for a few of the live calls that work for their time zones. So for those of you who live in the US and the times aren't convenient, I'm sorry. That is the thing that I hate about time zones is that it never works for everyone. And there's not a whole lot we can do about that. Am I missing anything? So, kind of the way that this will work during our workshops, we have six of these. Tonight's is the first. It's called Wake Up. This workshop is all about awareness because, as you will learn, that really is the foundation for everything that we're doing. Not just here in Feel Without Fear, but like in the journey. Generally, awareness is such a huge part of being able to make those shifts and get unstuck. I don't think it's possible without it, to be honest. So that's what tonight's workshop is all about. And then next week we will have a group coaching call. And if you, I will give you some homework at the end of tonight's workshop. So if you decide to work on the homework, then you can bring that to the group coaching call. You can also bring additional questions from tonight's workshop that maybe you think of later that you don't ask tonight to that group coaching call. You can bring any personal business life situation that you're going through. I really am here to be your coach as much as possible during this process on these calls. So I generally stay on for as long as possible or as long as necessary to answer all of your questions. I don't want to leave you with unanswered questions on the night of the workshop. I expect questions will come up later as you're doing the actual work, but I do try to stay on for as late as necessary. If you have to drop off for any reason, I know, I think for Sinead, it's like pretty late. It's like 11 o'clock at night. So, kudos and thank you. Like, I don't know that I would stay up for anyone past 11 o'clock at night. So I feel very honored. Thank you so much. So if you do have to drop off because it starts getting really late and you're tired and you want to go to sleep, please nourish yourself by sleeping. It's all recorded, so you can just catch what you missed on the replay. However, I do encourage you to come to as many live calls as you can because I don't know what it is, but everyone, including David, says that there is an energy in the live calls that just sometimes doesn't come across in the replays. So, I guess it is different. I don't know. It's very difficult for me to perceive myself that way. So, any other questions before we finally get started? You can put your questions in the chat now. I am looking at the chat right now, but when I start teaching, I'll close the chat. Oh, David will also be dropping, like, if I mention a book or a resource or something, David's going to drop the link to that, like, on Amazon in the chat for you. So if you're interested in checking it out, I encourage you to, like, copy and paste it in a new browser or open it in a new tab or something like that, in case you want to follow up with that. But he is really good about posting those links in the chat for you. Okay, I'm just pulling my slideshow up. So if y'all do have any questions, please just feel free to ask. We will have about an hour of teaching and then I will break. We'll take about 5 minutes so you can use the bathroom, get a drink, whatever you need to do. And then we'll come back and do the second half of the workshop and then we'll take another break and then we'll do the Q&A at the end. That's kind of the order of operations around here. Before we get started though, I do like to do fun things like draw cards. And since Danielle Lockwood was the first person here tonight, she showed up and listened to the playlist that I was DJing in the background. So Danielle, you get to be who chooses tonight's card. So choose one, two, or three. Three. Okay. Three it is. Oh, interesting. Tonight's card is Enter the Chamber of Healing. Hilarious. I've never even drawn this card before. I don't think I've ever seen it. Today is Lionsgate Portal. For those of you who don't know, it's like the most powerful manifestation day of the year. I have felt like I hit an energetic wall today. I told David earlier, I was like, I feel like a zombie and it's like 2 in the afternoon, but I feel like I hit an energetic wall. And then all day long, it was in the back of my head to like write down my things that I want to manifest as if it's happening already. And I like avoided it. And then I came down here in 15 minutes before we started. I like wrote them all down really, really fast. I did some energy work on myself. I like expanded my capacity to hold light. I felt chills and tingles all over. So I knew it was going to be powerful, but enter the chamber of healing. Here's tonight's card that is going to clearly support us for this entire time that we have together. A spiritual gift of healing is coming to you now. Be open without expectation or preconceived notions and allow the healing from the Lady Isis, Mistress of Magic, to help you find the best solution for any situation that does not appear to be as it should be. Take your time and create space into which her magic and energy can flow now. Expect your miracle. This oracle comes to you as a messenger. Prepare for great changes because they are on their way now. When the Divine Lady Isis offers you a healing gift of magic, it is something to accept as a gift of unconditional love with open arms. It will be offered without agenda, with the only intent being for your highest good and spiritual growth. It will not necessarily look or feel like you expected, but you will realize in the unfoldment of the process or circumstance that it was a spiritual healing gift from the divine, even though you may not have immediately recognized it at such a time. You will be able to recognize the healing by the experience of it and its effect, even before the complete resolution of the issue at hand. The experience will be that the issue is somehow lifted from you, and the effect will be that the issue seems genuinely out of your control and yet not out of control. That is the way the gift of healing can come to you. Time and sacred space to contemplate and reflect is extremely helpful to receive divine intervention as consciously, swiftly, and fully as possible. Sacred space can be a physical place that allows you to put your day-to-day activities and thoughts to one side and instead indulge in just being as you are in that moment. It might be a place in nature, your meditation place or healing room, or a sanctuary that you have where you can be alone for a time, or even a meditation group or healing circle. Sacred space allows you to simply be, to not have to think, sort out things, or analyze, but to open, rest, allow inspiration or guidance to come in as and when it chooses, and to allow for the mysteries of healing to occur. It is important when entering sacred space that we do not set an agenda or have any specific expectations. We do not have to think anything more than, I dedicate this space to the divine within. When not attempting to find solutions, but actually letting go mentally and emotionally and allowing ourselves to go into a peaceful state, relaxed but not numb, we can often have guidance, inspiration, clarity, and knowing drop into our awareness. We don't need to actively seek these things. They can just happen when we create open space. Healing happens most powerfully when there is space, openness, and allowing. We let go for healing to flow. Time and sacred space will help you receive the inner adjustments that you need for the healing magic of the Lady Isis to be able to reach you with full boldness and genius. Okay. That was fun. David, you might want to drop a link to this deck. I'll probably pull from this before every workshop. Okay. Everybody ready? I'm going to close the chat. If you are able to turn your camera on, that is amazing. If not, that is okay. But I do love to see your faces whenever I teach. It is so helpful for me. Okay. Now you can see my second screen just like I can. So welcome to Wake Up, everybody. I am Lindsay Loggett, as you know. I have been married to that very handsome gentleman in the photo next to me for it'll be 22 years in November. We have two dogs, two adult kids. One lives at home, one does not. For those of you who think I'm too young to have a child who doesn't live at home, I am 41 as of this year, as of May, I'm 41. I am a 1-3 emotional projector. Anyone know your human design? Yeah, we got any projectors in the house? Yeah, sweet. Okay, in astrology, I'm a Gemini sun, a Sagittarius moon, and a Pisces rising. If you're familiar with Myers-Briggs, I am an ENTJ or the commander. I am a great boss and a terrible employee. That's the personality that I have. My favorite foods are Tex-Mex, preferably from the South, dark chocolate, homemade pasta, and ginger lemon tea with honey. And my favorite color is any deep shade of blue. So, in case you don't know, I am not a licensed therapist, counselor, or healthcare provider. So, what I'm presenting here is for educational and informational purposes only. And we are not here to diagnose or treat any mental or physical health condition, and this presentation, nor I, am a substitute for mental and physical health care. So please be responsible for your health care choices. And also, this presentation, this entire program actually is all of my own original stuff. Where it is not original, I have cited sources for you. So I welcome you to take screenshots if you want to share them on social media and tag me. That would be amazing. But otherwise, please don't steal my shit. That's all. This is our first workshop. It's called Wake Up. We will have a group coaching call next week on Wednesday, August 14th at 1 p.m. So if you've not yet marked that in your calendar, please do so. Those calls are usually 90 minutes to 2 hours long. The next workshop is called Untriggered. In this workshop, we are going to talk about facing and overcoming triggers, using awareness, rewiring our brain and nervous system, and reprogramming the subconscious. That workshop is happening on Thursday, August 29th at 2 p.m. Central. And then the group call following that will be on Wednesday, September 4th at 12 p.m. Central. So, Feel Without Fear, the series is the answer to the most common question that I receive, which is, how did you get here and what was that process like? Basically, my now 5 years of healing journey, I have documented it all and journaled through it all and all of that to create somehow from that mess a cohesive thing, which is what you're going to experience. It's the cohesive thing out of that knot that I untangled. So this is my own healing journey in coaching form, and it seems to work for many people. Or it seems to be helpful, not work. I don't like to use work, but it seems to be very helpful in helping people get off of their various hamster wheels of healing everything all the time. So, and my journey, as with everyone's, I think, started with awareness. So this cute little diagram, is kind of what, this is my autistic representation picture in my head that I did my very best to create with very limited graphic design experience or tools. So, this cute little you holding the balloon, is you, and then all of these concentric circles coming out of you are all things that, in one way or another, whether you're conscious of them or not, are influencing, informing, affecting, and programming you, right? And it started from before you were born, even. So awareness is like those concentric circles. It's ever expanding and it builds on itself. And as soon as you're aware of one thing, you become aware that you're aware. And then suddenly you're at a different level of awareness. So awareness is like you're always watching whatever is happening, whatever you're feeling, noticing, experiencing, or thinking in that moment, you are aware of it. You don't have thoughts or feelings or desires or whatever that you just ignore or silence or bypass or pretend it doesn't exist or whatever. You are aware of it and watching it. And that is what begins to inform how you show up in the world. And it ultimately, awareness of what you feel is how you find what feels authentic. So I'm when I talk about awareness, I'm talking about cognitive awareness, and I'm also talking about somatic awareness. So awareness of what's going on in your head and awareness of what's going on in your body. So feelings and sensations are things that we've always had. None of us gets a life without feelings or sensations. And because they are inherent, they are inherent, but they are not inherently bad or wrong. But because we're influenced by our environments, so collectively through parenting, entertainment, books, and other conditioning from all of those concentric circles, depending on the messages that we got from those sources, we become conditioned to judge and pathologize our feelings and our sensations. So, conditioning, which is judgmental of feelings, is by default judgmental of sensation because we can't have one without the other. So you'll hear me use words like feeling, sensation, and symptoms like pretty interchangeably. They all mean the same thing. Conditioning that pathologizes sensation creates a disembodied, disconnected, and diseased society because the more we pathologize something, the more we other it. And when we other something, then we have to make ourselves separate from us, and we can't make ourselves separate from our own bodies without like a whole lot of adaptation. That's really not great, right? So here's some examples of conditioning from environment, whether that is your family of origin, society, culture, social media, or anything else. Things like boys don't cry, thinking that we're bitchy, hormonal, and PMSy whenever we have like normal physiological cycle changes, and the ways that that gets weaponized against us. Feeling slow and sad during the winter, right? We diagnose that as seasonal affective disorder, and yet it is a time when nothing grows. So, but because we're not growing, there must be something wrong, right? That's conditioning. That's not real. Like, yes, the sadness is real. Absolutely. The experience of it is real. But the fact that there's something wrong with it is what's not real. There's nothing wrong with it. Conditioning where probably most of us were taught that our periods were gross, smelly, disgusting. We don't talk about them, especially in front of mixed company. If we need extra time to rest and recover after birth, that is also a diagnosable medical condition called postpartum depression. When you feel like a boy and a girl at the same time, or you don't conform to gender norms, that is also diagnosable as a disorder with potential surgical and hormonal alterations to like make that happen. So all of these things are, I mean, these are just like a handful of millions and millions and millions of ways that we've all been conditioned. We could put religion in here. If you grew up with any kind of high control religion, we could put, any kind of abuse in here. We could put what you learned in institutional educational systems, institutional healthcare systems, like all of those things contribute to our conditioning. So what does this have to do with our awareness? Well, if we go back to our little self with our balloon and all the things that we can be aware of, this is my best representation of the infinite part of you who watches all of it. Scientifically, we are more energy than we are matter. There is more space between the atoms of our bodies than there are atoms in our bodies. So that means we are more energy than we are matter. Our body is made up of more space than it is made up of solid material. But because we are in a 3D realm, what we can see is the density. Right? Everything that we see is the density, but everything, even without its density, is still an energy. So your body is made up of more space than solid material. You are not your body. You have a body, but you're not your body. And you're also not your mind. So you're not the things that you think, and you're not this meat suit. Okay? Like the thing that makes you you is this infinite part of you. It's just driving the meat suit like a car for a lifetime that it has to like maintain frequently, right? We can observe it all of it. We can observe what we think, we can observe what we feel. We can't be that thing if we are also observing it. So I personally refer to this infinite part of myself, the thing that makes me me, as my consciousness or my soul or my spirit. I will also use higher self or most loving, most trusting, wisest part of myself. I use all of those terms interchangeably. If the word spiritual brings up discomfort for you, I totally get it. I am a former evangelical Christian. And depending on how long you followed me and how much you know about my journey, like from listening to my podcast or reading my book or whatever, I have a lot of religious trauma from growing up in a high control religion. And it took me a while after coming out of that to get to a place where I felt comfortable with spirituality apart from religion and how I had to redefine that for myself. So if spiritual brings up discomfort for you, I get it. Just be present with where you feel that discomfort. Just notice it. You can begin that awareness practice now by just noticing, like, oh, part of me feels uncomfortable because she's using the term soul, or she's saying that I have a body, but I'm not my body. Like, your discomfort is totally welcome here. So you don't have to call this infinite part of you what I call it. You can call it your higher self, your true self, your authentic self, the observer, the watcher, soul, spirit, consciousness, whatever feels right for you. The important thing is that you understand that you are a spiritual being, and spiritual does not equal religious or Christian or believer or anything like that. You don't have to have a label for it. It doesn't have to meet a certain set of parameters. It doesn't have to follow any specific tradition. Like, apart from all of that, you still have a spirit, and that is all that spiritual means. So, my consciousness, this infinite part of me, is the watcher of the being who identifies as me. So, if you've done any kind of studying of like yogis or Eckhart Tolle or anything like that, like this is like consciousness and spirituality 101, that you have this part of you who can watch the being who identifies as me, like me, right? My consciousness or my soul or my true self or whatever you like to call that is not identified with my body or anything about my body. My most infinite part of myself is not identified with my gender or my race or my sexuality or my ability or my age, my weight, like nothing. It's not identified with my socioeconomic status. All the things that we identify with are all ego. They're not part of spirit or self, higher self. So, if you notice again resistance in your body to this, just place a hand on the part of you where you might be feeling resistance. Oftentimes, it shows up in people's throats or in their bellies. And so, if that's happening for you as I'm saying all of this, there's some part of you that's like, but, like, that's okay. It's okay to notice that discomfort. There's space for it. Just put a hand on that part of your body wherever you feel it and offer that space, breath, and presence. You don't have to change anything. You can just be with it for a moment. If you've got a voice in your head that's telling a story about it or telling a story about me or whatever, just notice that too. Okay. Just see if you can be present with it. If you could notice that there was a voice in your head saying things about me or about this course, voicing offense or doubt or maybe fear, then you were in conscious awareness. And that watcher slash observer part of you was watching and observing the voice in your head and the discomfort that you felt about me saying that your consciousness is without gender, race, sexual orientation, age, weight, socioeconomic status, etc. We did not invoke God. We did not pray. We did not meditate. We did nothing to do with any religion. We were just simply present and aware. So whether you have a spiritual practice, or you're part of a lineage of yoga or anything else, if you follow modern spiritual teachers, whether you attend church or not, pray or not, believe in God or not, the bottom line is that you have a part of you that is not your body and it is not your mind, and it can observe and notice and ask questions about everything. Everything about the being who identifies as you, the watcher of that being, can be curious about all of it and notice all of it without judgment. That is your conscious awareness. So, when you are curiously observing the ramblings of your mind, which is often what meditation teaches, right? Like whether you're watching the thought go by on a river, or you're watching the thought pass by like a cloud, that's observing the ramblings of your mind. That is conscious awareness. When you're feeling the sensations of your body and you're being present with those sensations, that is somatic awareness. That is also awareness. And when you're curious about whatever is happening, you're in awareness. When you can be curious instead of jumping to a judgment or a meaning or anything else, you're just like open and curious. That's also conscious awareness. So, awareness is like a muscle. The more we strengthen it by using it and stretching it, the stronger it gets. And at first, it feels weird and unfamiliar to kind of pause and check in with your body to notice what's there. If you experience health anxiety, maybe you're already familiar with pausing and checking in with your body all the time, but you're checking in with your body from a place of fear versus a place of like trust and safety. So it can feel unfamiliar to do that, and it definitely requires a repatterning. It can feel strange to feel like you're watching yourself while you're having a conversation with someone. But again, with practice, it gets easier. If you deal with dissociation in any way, sometimes it can be hard to distinguish between feeling outside of everything and being in awareness. like actually being present and aware versus being dissociated and kind of on the outside looking in. Anybody getting the nuance of what I'm saying there? Okay, wonderful. So with devotion and practice, awareness gets easier and it will even feel more natural over time. Living in awareness gives us access to our power of choice. It stops us from blindly following the conditioning, meaning that we're not on autopilot. When we're in our conditioning, when we're in our adaptive patterning, when we're just going along and doing the things because that's what is expected of us, but it's not necessarily authentic for us, that is being on autopilot. That is what I'm talking about when I say you're blindly following conditioning. So inside of that conditioning, you have all of these choices, but you're not aware of those choices. And that's why you keep living in the conditioning. The moment you become aware is the moment suddenly all of these perspectives and possibilities that weren't available to you in unawareness are now available to you. And the more perspectives and possibilities you have, the more choice you have. And the more choice you have, the more likely it is that you're going to choose something that feels authentic because only the ad adaptive patterning was making you choose what was inauthentic. And this requires slowing down. When we have the ability to go more slowly, we can be more present. And for people with anxiety or people who are used to just rushing about in their lives all the time, slowing down can be a very uncomfortable process for you. But I highly recommend starting to practice slowness because it will only serve to benefit you. I've never encountered a situation where slowing down did not benefit me ever. So I'm going to use the phrases living in awareness and coming into awareness a lot. And this is because awareness is a state of being. It's not about doing or taking action. You can do and take action from a place of awareness, but awareness itself is not about doing, it's about being. It is simply observational and curious. It's a state that we can enter into and exit out of. And when we live in awareness, this presence becomes a state of being. So, again, presence is also a word for awareness. In this state of presence, there is more space, more possibility, more peace, and more intuition. So, again, living in awareness is never going to not benefit you. And it requires slowing down, which will also never not benefit you. Anybody familiar with the book or the practice of existential kink? Okay, this is a quote from Carolyn Elliott, the author of that book. She says, "We could venture to guess that the vast self," so that's what she's calling the soul, the spirit, the true self, the vast self, "is unconscious in most modern human beings because we all seem to have a strong interest in experiencing ourselves as separate, alienated egos, little isolated particles who exist at the mercy of cruel fate and outside circumstance." Think about it. If the self contains everything, then the way to experience yourself as separate is to identify yourself with only one side of a polarity and to disdain the other side, to pretend it's so not you. If you're in the US right now, it's an election year. And boy, do people ever love to identify with one polarity because the other one is so not me, right? The self with a capital S is the primal selfhood of everything and everyone, which is paradoxically also our own inner selfhood. This is so because self is infinite consciousness. It's as if all of us humans are light bulbs, and the self is the electricity that powers us. In becoming more identified with this underlying whole that we share with everyone, we paradoxically become more uniquely individual because we become free of our attachments to conventional socially prescribed roles. What she's talking about there is authenticity, which, if you haven't caught on yet, that is the entire purpose of everything we're doing here. So here are some things that you need to know about the part of you that is your infinite self. It has no race, gender, age, weight, sexual orientation, ability level, neurodivergence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever identities you want to insert. It is neutral, non-judgmental, and curious. It is all things. All polarity exists inside of you. All duality exists inside of you, as well as every gray shade in between. And the universe, the whole reason we all exist is because the universe likes to experience itself. And literally everything that's happening in our lives or around the world like it or not, this is not spiritually bypassing, this is what helps me stay sane in an insane world, is the universe playing with itself. Because all duality has to exist, which means in order for there to be light, there has to be dark. In order for there to be peace, there has to be war. In order for there to be love, there has to be hate. This is the nature of duality. It's uncomfortable. And we hold all of it within us. We hold the masculine and the feminine in us. We hold the shadow and the light within us. Your higher self is all of that. It is not a perfect little angel flying in heaven who, like, is only ever thinking amazing things. Like, it is all of you, it is all experiences, and it is however you show up authentically in those experiences. It incarnated in human form to experience the spectrum of duality. Your higher self or your infinite self is not, it is not the voice in your head. It is not your inner critic. It is not the voice that is full of shame for you. It is not the voice that tells you you're unworthy. It is not the voice that judges other people. It is not the voice that judges yourself. And your infinite self is not your emotions or your sensations or your thoughts or your symptoms. Awareness itself, consciousness, presence is not hypervigilant. Okay. So hypervigilance has that hawk energy, right? The hawk is like swirling and flying overhead, like just looking for every little detail. That's hypervigilance. No. Okay. Presence is like floating in the ocean, enjoying the fish. If you've ever been snorkeling and you just like lay face down in the water with your eyes open and just breathe and watch the fish below you, that's the energy of presence, not this like, oh, I've got to find something wrong all the time energy. Okay. Awareness is not a perfectionist. If there's a voice in your head that's like, I have to get this right. Okay. That's perfectionism. No. Okay. No. Isn't it interesting that I'm trying to be perfect at this? Yes. Do you feel the difference in spaciousness around one versus the other? I hope you can feel it. Yes. Okay. Awareness is not overanalyzing, nor is it intellectualizing. Okay. In awareness, there's nothing to figure out. Awareness is not a tool to solve a problem necessarily, because sometimes in awareness, you realize, oh, there actually is no problem. See what I mean? And awareness is not disappointed in you or in anyone else. Awareness is, however, presence is curious. Whatever it is simply something interesting to observe. When we can switch into curiosity, that is the antidote to judgment. Judgment is not going, oh, this is interesting to observe. Judgment is going, you piece of trash, right? So, like, no to that energy. Yes to, like, oh, isn't it interesting? This is interesting to watch. Okay. Awareness is pretty neutral. That doesn't mean you never want anything or you never feel any emotion whatsoever. Again, you are duality. You are all of it and the gray in between. But awareness itself, by being non-judgmental and curious, is neutral. It's not, oh my God, look at her. She's so bad. It's, oh, isn't it interesting? I'm sure in the context of her life experience, her behavior makes sense. Space. Awareness is present. It's not focused on the past. It's not focused on the future. It knows that right now is the only moment that exists. My friend Mark gave me the phrase. I borrowed it from him. This is what's happening. That is the phrase in our friend group. Whenever whatever is happening is happening. It's just, well, this is what's happening. And it just brings everyone into a sense of acceptance. Like, even if we laugh or cry, it's like, well, this is what's happening. That's presence. Awareness is directly tied to your power to consciously choose. So again, in awareness, you have possibilities and perspectives that were not available to you when you were unconscious that now become available to you, which is powerful. Awareness is an amazing agent for neuroplasticity. Does everyone know what neuroplasticity is, or do I need to explain that? Okay, great. It's the brain's ability to rewire itself. So, how does awareness work to help you rewire your brain? Well, again, if you think about it, if you're in the programming, if you're in the conditioning, you've got that behavior, that thought pattern, that adaptive survival pattern going like a river through the Grand Canyon in your brain, right? That neural pathway is deep and wide, and it's familiar to travel that pathway. Well, when you become conscious of that pathway in your brain that you're traveling and you become aware of it and you shift it, you choose something different, guess what? Every time you choose something different, you're diverting a little more of that water away from this heavily used channel and you're sending it into this new channel that you're making over here. Okay, so how can you do that without awareness? It literally is a catalyst for neuroplasticity. Awareness is present with whatever is happening and whatever you're feeling and whatever the voice in your head is saying. Awareness is not reactive. It's not believing all the stories in your head. It's not telling you have to react a certain way to a certain situation. It's just present with whatever is happening and it's noticing whatever the voice in your head is doing. Presence is also accepting of whatever's happening. Presence knows if it was meant to be different, it would be, you know? And again, that's not spiritually bypassing. Like if it was meant to be different, it would be. And if it's not, then this is what's happening. And we may not like it. We don't have to like it, but this is what's happening, whatever this is. All right, let's take a few moments now to just practice awareness. So stop looking at your screen if you want to gaze loosely and lightly at the floor, if you want to gaze out a window, if you want to close your eyes, whatever works for you. Whatever helps, just become aware of your breathing. Do not change how you're breathing. Just become aware that you're breathing. Maybe you've been learning about the importance of deep, slow breathing. And when you became aware that you were breathing, you noticed that your breath was not deep and slow, and so you changed it. So, in awareness, we're not seeking to change anything. We're just being present with what is first. So, just continue noticing how your breath feels as it moves in and out of your body. Notice if you're breathing through your nose or your mouth. Notice if there's sound when you breathe. Maybe it's whistling a little bit. Notice the sensation of the air on your skin as it flows in and out of your nostrils. You can notice your chest rising and falling. Now, stay present with your breath, and at the same time, notice your right hand. You don't need to move it or adjust it or change anything that your right hand is doing. Just notice. Can you be aware of your breath and your right hand at the same time? You can nod yes if you can. You can nod no if you can't. Couple no's. Stay with it. Notice your breath. And notice your right hand. You can practice this if you'd like to be able to have multiple things in your awareness at once. As you're doing this practice, are you also noticing a voice in your head? Is your mind thinking and talking incessantly inside your head? Just be aware of that too. Notice what that voice is saying. Notice whatever meaning it's trying to make out of this practice. Maybe you don't have a voice in your head. Maybe you're just quiet and curious. Great. Maybe the voice in your head is doubting or second guessing your decision to be here. Maybe it's making a grocery list. Doesn't matter. Just notice. Okay, that's it. You have now successfully practiced awareness. You can give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Was that, if it was easy, thumbs up, hard, thumbs down? Ish. Okay. Ish. Great. Great. So keep practicing that with consistent practice. You will become aware of sensation in your body, the voice in your head, your triggers, your patterns, and many more unconscious things. So now I'd like to shift and talk about complex PTSD. Anybody here does not know what complex PTSD is? Wonderful. Anybody here diagnosed themselves with complex PTSD or been formally diagnosed? Either one, doesn't matter. Okay. Anybody curious about complex PTSD? Okay, cool. Well, let's talk about it. So, complex PTSD usually, but not always, forms in childhood. It was the water we were swimming in. It's kind of the like the thing that is all around you and all around everybody all the time, but nobody notices it's there because it's so normal and so present. When we were children, we did not have the ability to understand that our caregivers' inability to attune to our needs and co-regulate with us was not our fault. Children really don't have the ability to recognize that when their parent doesn't attune, that it's not their fault. And so what this forms with complex PTSD is, are these deep core beliefs that there's something wrong with me. Even if you can't quite put your finger on what's wrong with you, maybe you've always felt different. Maybe you've always felt on the outside looking in. Maybe you've always felt like you don't belong socially, awkward socially. Maybe perfectionism has been a driving part of your life in a way that seems more debilitating than other people, at least in your perception. Yeah, those are the types of things where, like, there's something wrong with me, right? Complex PTSD can form alongside adverse childhood experiences, but not always. David will put a link in the chat for you. If you do not know your ACEs score, that's your adverse childhood experiences score. There's a free place that you can go and answer 10 questions. You score yourself out of 10, and that's your ACEs score. So the most common client that I run across is someone who has a low ACEs score. Meaning like 0 to 3, low ACEs score. And then they come to me going, but I didn't have that much happen to me. I didn't have that bad of a childhood. I had it pretty good. Like, and so it's almost like sometimes I feel like I have to like convince them that they have trauma because they're comparing their trauma to other people's and going, oh, but I didn't have it that bad. I had it pretty okay. There are other people who have a higher ACEs score and also have complex PTSD. I'm one of those people. I have an ACEs score of 6 or 7. I'm unclear on the sexual abuse part, so I don't know if it's a 6 or 7. So that's a higher ACEs score. I also have severe complex PTSD. So I have both. I have a PTSD diagnosis as well. So whether your ACEs score is high or not doesn't matter. You could still have complex PTSD. That's where I'm going with that. Complex PTSD often feels like being hypervigilant about your environment or communication cues. Your nervous system is chronically dysregulated. It's easily triggered. When you're immobilized in your nervous system, you fawn and people please. It's common to second guess, to doubt, to even gaslight yourself. Complex PTSD seems nebulous. It's like you can't quite put your finger on what's wrong. And it's very common for people with complex PTSD to have the belief that their childhood wasn't that bad. This is a quote from this book, which David will link in the chat. If you have not read this book yet, please run to Amazon and buy this and have it shipped to you immediately. So this is a quote from that book. CPTSD is a learned set of responses and a failure to complete numerous important developmental tasks. This means that it is environmentally, not genetically caused. CPTSD is neither inborn nor characterological. As such, it is learned. It is not inscribed in your DNA. It is a disorder caused by nurture, or rather, lack of it, not nature. What is learned can be unlearned and vice versa. What was not provided your parents can now be provided by yourself and others. Complex PTSD is a more severe form of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it is delineated from PTSD by 5 common and troublesome features. So these are things that people with PTSD generally do not experience in a way that people with complex PTSD do. Emotional flashbacks. Now, people with PTSD, of course, they have flashbacks and triggers, right? If they were in a bombing in their unit or like gunfires and missiles, fireworks go off on the 4th of July, they're triggered as fuck. That's not the kind of trigger I'm talking about. I'm talking about emotional triggers where you don't necessarily get a flash of a memory, you don't get a picture of, or a movie or something like that, but you just have this feeling in your body that you can't shake. And sometimes it can go on for hours, sometimes days, sometimes weeks. You can be more sensitive during those times. At least for me, that's what happens. Like when I'm in an abandonment trigger, it's like at the surface. And so in all of my secure attachment relationships, I'm very sensitive emotionally, even though I don't have like a picture in my head of being abandoned and not being triggered in that moment. complex PTSD sufferers typically experience more toxic shame. We are very prone to abandoning ourselves, and that is because we learned to abandon ourselves in order to avoid being abandoned. We have a vicious voice in our head that we call the inner critic, and we can experience a lot of social anxiety because complex PTSD happens in relationships, which is also another way that it's differentiated from post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's always relational in nature. Because we have such unsafe experiences in relationships, that can cause us to have a lot of social anxiety because we learned very early on that relationships weren't safe or that we couldn't trust them. So let's talk about emotional flashbacks. We can also refer to them as triggers. These are sudden and often prolonged regressions to overwhelming feeling states of being abused or abandoned. Feeling state. It includes overwhelming fear, shame, alienation, rage, grief, and depression. I would throw anxiety in there as well. I should remake the slide and include anxiety. It unnecessarily triggers our fight flight response. So it's like the nervous system is detecting a threat, but the threat isn't actually happening. The threat is rooted in the past, not in what's happening in front of me. I'm just triggered by what's happening in front of me because it's reminding me of the past. And triggers can range in intensity from subtle to really, really bad, and they can last for a few moments or they can last for weeks. So here are the air quote symptoms of complex PTSD. So we have triggers, we have an inner critic, toxic shame, self-abandonment, social anxiety. We feel lonely or feel abandoned. We can have a fragile self-esteem. If you don't take criticism well, or even if somebody tells you 99 things that you did right, but then they tell you one thing that you could improve on, you can only focus on the one thing and not the 99 things you did right. That can be a fragile self-esteem. Suicidal ideation, anxious, avoidant, or disorganized attachment, developmental arrests, relationship difficulties, mood swings, dissociation, oversensitivity, and intolerance to stress. You could also add to this autoimmune illnesses, chronic fatigue, chronic pain, things like that. The body speaks very loudly when the body has CPTSD that is unresolved or it has not un been unburdened from the nervous system yet. Complex PTSD is often misdiagnosed as, no surprises, ADHD. Generalized anxiety disorder, bipolar disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, neurodivergence, gender dysphoria, panic disorder, borderline, OCD, major depressive disorder, and autism spectrum disorder. The great question of my life at this point in my career is kind of a chicken or the egg question. And it's like, okay, what came first? The neurodivergence, and then I was more susceptible to complex PTSD, or do I have complex PTSD, and that's why my brain doesn't work like everybody else's brains? I don't know, but that is a big question in my life right now. I am also on the autism spectrum and I have ADHD as well. I see my neurodivergence as more of a gift than a curse at this point. And so, in that way, I can kind of differentiate it from complex PTSD because complex PTSD doesn't feel good necessarily. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. If you guys want to think about that and get back to me, I'd be interested to know, like, chicken or egg, what came first? The abuse and then the neurodivergence, or the neurodivergence made us more sensitive to abuse and then we have complex PTSD? I don't know. All right. Renowned traumatologist John Breyer once said, if complex PTSD were ever given its due, DSM, used by all mental health professionals, would shrink from its dictionary-like size to the size of a thin pamphlet. In other words, the role of traumatized childhoods in most adult psychological disorders is enormous. So he's basically saying if we could include complex PTSD as a formal diagnosis, like a laundry list of other diagnoses would go away because they're all basically rooted in complex PTSD. So I think it's important that we don't get attached to our labels and diagnoses, such as complex PTSD or autism or neurodivergence or whatever else. We know that complex PTSD is not genetic, it's learned. So these adaptations that we have learned to survive can be unlearned, and awareness is a huge part of that. It is our responsibility to use our agency to become aware of these patterns, behaviors, triggers, and beliefs and unlearn them. It will make our life better and less painful, and it will make our relationships so much better. When I use the term complex PTSD, it's not an attempt to identify with a diagnosis or like feel like a victim or get people to feel sorry for me or make it seem like I have a bunch of things wrong with me. It's just language that succinctly describes a collection of beliefs, nervous system states, emotional states, behavioral patterns, all stemming from emotional abandonment and neglect, which is the core of complex PTSD, is emotional abandonment and neglect. I follow this PhD, her name is Dr. Ramani, and she talks about narcissism on Instagram, and she talks about the diagnosis narcissistic personality disorder as like if you were to think of like an entire cake that's already been baked versus if you hand someone like eggs and flour and sugar and butter, you don't hand them all those ingredients and call it a cake. It's only when those ingredients are put together that it creates a cake. So like the different facets of narcissistic personality disorder is like it's like if gaslighting is eggs and manipulation is the butter and trying to control people is the sugar. You put all of that together, that makes the cake. That's narcissistic personality disorder. You can think of the same way as a thing as CPTSD. It's like the hypervigilance are the eggs and the butter is the anxiety and the sugar is the catastrophization and all of those things put together, bake the cake. It's called complex PTSD. I hope that helps make sense of it. Because I don't like to live by labels. And I also don't qualify for a lot of my mental health diagnoses anymore because I'm not symptomatic anymore and haven't been for quite some time. So I'm not attached to them. I encourage you not to be either. But man, when I learned about complex PTSD, especially after I read this book, I was like, this guy just read my freaking life and wrote it in a book. That was how much it resonated. So I want to give you my own personal example of how complex PTSD often shows up for me. So in my close attachment relationships, I am extra sensitive to verbal and nonverbal communication cues. Verbal cues are things like tone of voice, inflection, volume, and actual words. Nonverbal cues are things like facial expression, body language, things like that. I often perceive some of these cues as threatening when they are not actually a threat, depending on where my abandonment trigger is. If it's very high, then I am more likely to perceive a communication cue as threatening versus when I am not in that emotional flashback state. So the voice in my head, which used to be unconscious, made up stories when these triggers would happen about me. It would say that I was going to be left. It would say that this person was disappointed in me, or they didn't approve of me, or they were mad at me, or that I did something wrong and I wasn't ever going to know what it was so I could make it right. The voice in my head would make up stories about the other person, our relationship, whatever. And then it would catastrophize the worst because my deepest wound, so my deepest fear is abandonment and the loss of my intimate relationships now. So when I am not conscious and aware of this pattern of perceiving a threat where a threat doesn't exist, I will become defensive and angry. I will pick fights. It's like an anxious anger. It's like, what's wrong? Are you mad at me? Like, it's like an anxious anger, if that makes sense. So I am looking for confirmation that what I fear is actually happening so that I can do whatever it takes to protect myself from feeling abandoned. So if I can know based on your facial expressions and tone of voice and body language what your next move is going to be, and if I perceive that your next move is going to be that you're leaving me, then if I can be hypervigilant enough, maybe I can predict what you're going to do before you do it and stop you from leaving me. Okay? That's kind of the hole that it takes me into. Because I now am much more conscious and aware of this tendency and the old patterns of picking a fight or becoming defensive or anxious, they don't get me the outcome I want. What I want is reassurance and deeper emotional intimacy and safety. When I pick a fight or get crazy anxious, I am not in service of the outcome that I want. I want to feel emotionally safe. If I make someone else feel emotionally unsafe, trying to feel emotionally safe for myself, I'm not getting what I want. So I have learned to say to the other person, I become aware, oh, the hypervigilance is there. Okay. Hey, I noticed your facial expression and your tone of voice sounded like this. And the voice in my head says it means that you're mad at me or that I disappointed you or I pissed you off or I offended you or whatever. Is that what's happening right now? Am I interpreting your communication cues correctly? That's what I've learned to do. Not once when I've done this has the other person ever said, "Yep, the voice in your head is telling you the truth. I'm probably going to leave you because you just did this." Not once, right? This has been really healing for me. Like it, every time that happens, it gives me another disconfirming experience that I'm not being abandoned when I thought I might be being abandoned. And I don't mean healed, like I no longer have this trigger, or I no longer ever feel fear or shame, or I don't have voices in my head anymore. That's not what I mean when I say healed. I mean healed because to go from being in this reactive, unconscious, picking fights, defensive, anxious energy to slowing down, noticing my body, and going, hey, when you use this tone of voice, and you, I noticed you used a past tense verb there. And when you use past tense verbs, when you talk about loving me, it makes me think that loving me is in the past and not in the present. Is that really what you meant? And that's actually a conversation I've had with my husband. I can be so sensitive that I notice the tense of the verb that people are using. So I'm not saying healed, like that's all gone. Okay. I think it's a big deal to even be able to have this awareness. I think it's a big deal to give it real language in my relationships and to communicate about it in the middle of a scary moment. That feels much more healed and much more realistic than, oh, look, I don't deal with this anymore. Woohoo, I'm totally healed, right? So hopefully you're seeing with that example how powerful awareness can be. Not only can we calmly notice, but we can also notice our typical patterns and dysfunctional coping behaviors in action and then make the choice to change them. Awareness is where our power comes from. It's a catalyst for our neuroplasticity. It's how we come out of inauthentic living to embody our authenticity. You notice, you get curious, you choose. You do it again and again and again. And we're going to go into a lot more detail for a process that can help you with that later. So, the single greatest thing that's helped me more than nervous system work and more than brain healing is just having an awareness of the voice in my head and being able to notice what it says. When I am not aware of that voice in my head, I make unconscious choices that almost never get me the outcome I want because I subconsciously believe what that voice in my head says. In awareness, I can choose not to believe that voice or take action based on what it fears. I don't believe that we can regulate our nervous system so much that these scared, wounded parts of us stop taking up space in our minds and bodies. I do believe that there are some things that are programmed into our subconscious that we're probably never going to totally overcome. I also don't think that we need to get rid of those parts of us or to get rid of that voice in our head in order to be healed. So, what does awareness have to do with feeling somatic awareness without fear? It has everything to do with it. So, societal and cultural conditioning has pathologized our sensations and feelings to the point that we think what we feel is the problem, whether that's a symptom, that's a sensation, whether that's an emotion, which is also a sensation, right? So whether it's emotional or physical, we've been conditioned to be like, these are bad. It's bad if you have symptoms. You should get something to fix it. You should get something to calm it down or make it go away. You should do this diet or this protocol or this whatever to fix that symptom because it's bad, right? So we try to control our sensations, micromanage them, medicate them, get rid of them, wish them away, pray them away, bargain them away, ignore them, hyperfixate on them, catastrophize about them, and even kill ourselves over them. So it's no wonder that we think our feelings are the problem. Of course, we don't want to feel our feelings. We think they're the problem. In our very feeling phobic culture, feelings are made to be the problem. They are labeled as good and bad and positive and negative. Blech. I invite you to remove those words from your vocabulary around feelings. Feelings are not the problem. Feelings are just neutral. They're just energy. The challenge, and probably why you've been triggered by feelings or living in avoidance of feeling, is that you've likely not known how to meet what you're feeling with awareness. So, for example, anger, right? We all have stories about anger, that it's bad, that it's wrong, it's inappropriate. If I'm angry, I'll hurt someone. If I'm angry, I'm like my dad. If I'm angry, I'm going to get punished. No one will listen to me, whatever his story is. So we form the judgment, oh, I can't be angry. That's wrong. That's bad. But it's not. You can be unconsciously angry, and that's when you're like yelling or slamming doors or hurting yourself or other people. You can also be consciously angry. And that gives you the energy that you need to set boundaries, assert yourself, lead, have courage. But when we judge anger, then we're in unchallenged, unconscious conditioning. So, what I mean by judging anger, here's what that means. What I see when I work with women is typically two very common patterns. There are others, but these are the two most common. This is their relationship with anger. One, they were raised in a home with one or both parents who had very harmful, unconscious, mutated expressions of anger. So their experience of anger from one or both caregivers was scary, violent, rageful, shaming, whatever it was. So as the child, they see this and they see how hurtful it is. And we subconsciously, again, we don't have control over this, we're children, but we subconsciously create the story. If anger looks like that, then I don't want any part of it. I can't be angry. And then what do we do whenever we get angry? We stuff it down. We don't feel it. It becomes like the big bad wolf. We don't want to acknowledge it because we don't know how to be angry and it not look like that. Okay. Second most common pattern that I see with anger, again, raised with a scary, angry parent. And then when you got angry yourself by throwing a fit, a tantrum, saying no, trying to have a boundary with your parents, whatever it was, and you got punished. You got spanked, beaten, sent to your room, timeout, grounded, whatever else. So then your relationship with anger becomes another one of judgment, which is when I get angry, I get punished. So I can't be angry or something bad will happen to me. So those are the two common patterns I see with anger. Both of those are conditioned patterns because anger itself is not bad or wrong. But when you're in that conditioning, the judgment says, oh, anger is bad. Anger is wrong. And you are bad if you are angry. Does this resonate with anybody? Is this like helpful at all? Okay, wonderful. Anxiety, believe it or not, it's not bad. when we have unconscious anger, I'm sorry, anxiety, then that's when we're like worrying and trying to control things and catastrophizing, and we have all those awful anxiety sensations in our bodies. But when anxiety is conscious, it can be channeled into meeting a hurting part of ourselves and healing a wound at the root rather than trying to control others and outcomes. In, let's see, four workshops, three more workshops, I'm going to teach you about the nervous system states, primary emotions, and what they look like when unintegrated and what they look like when integrated to give you more neutrality and less judgment around emotion. When we judge anxiety, that comes from our own experiences of how bad anxiety is because we didn't know how to meet ourselves consciously when we were in it. Horror stories of other people's anxiety, how we witnessed unconscious people handle anxiety, having a fear of anxiety, and we get fear from and judgment from anxiety about the pharmaceutical and medical industries and from health and wellness world on the internet. Grief, also not bad, not wrong, not comfortable, but not bad. When our grief is not conscious, we can drown in it. We can become immobilized and stuck, depressed. When it's conscious, though, we can channel it into honoring and feeling our pain. We can give our grief somewhere to go. We can let all the love that we'll never be able to give, like fill our bodies and let us feel that, and our tears can cleanse us. But when we judge grief, that comes from conditioning that tells us that we don't have time for that. Our fear that we won't be able to handle grief, that it'll be too much, that we'll drown in it. When we watch other people go through grief in unconscious ways, like if you had to watch a grandparent or a family member who was so grieved that they became an alcoholic or something, like your judgment of grief might be, oh my God, if that's what grief looks like, I don't want any part of it. No grief, right? And then finally, fear itself isn't bad or wrong. You need to know what fear feels like in order to survive. Like you really do. If you didn't know what fear felt like, you wouldn't have a fight flight response to get you out of the bear in the woods, right? But when our fear is unconscious, it limits us and it can make us be stuck. But when it's conscious, we can have discernment and we can use our judgment, not judgment like, oh, that's bad, but judgment like discernment to make the right choice for us and understand that fear is simply a messenger. Fear shows us like where we have courage that we haven't yet used. Right? It's not always bad. But when we judge fear, that comes from not meeting it with awareness to recognizing it, how facing it is actually easier than avoiding it. We love to resist fear, which is weird. All right. Whatever you're feeling, whatever sensations or symptoms you have, they are not bad or wrong. Whatever story you might have that if you're experiencing this health issue, this anxiety issue, this body issue, this relationship issue, whatever the issue is, If there is a story in you that's like, I should not be experiencing it. This is bad. This is wrong. It should be different. It's not supposed to be this way. Whatever it is, like, I just invite you to let that go. Those things, including what we feel in our bodies, are not supposed to be there. And they're not a punishment. And they're not your body's way of punishing you or getting back at you. And it's not karma being a bitch. Okay. It's just you being a human. So we can like release all of those stories. But we have to quit trying to stop feeling. We have to quit trying to think our way out of feeling or mantra our way out of it or regulate our nervous systems out of a feeling or being really, really positive to try to bypass a feeling or whatever else. We have to stop that shit. Our feelings are not bad. They're just messengers. How else is your body going to speak to you? Your body does not speak Chinese or English or French. Your body speaks in sensation. When we avoid or try to get rid of feeling, that's when we're resisting. And when we resist, we're suffering. If you are in resistance of something, that's why you feel like you're suffering. When you are resisting, you are not in congruence with yourself, meaning higher self, consciousness, soul, spirit, whatever you like to call that. And being incongruent with your authenticity, with yourself, is unbearable. It's very, very uncomfortable, but that's what resistance is. You are not suffering when you're feeling a sensation or an emotion. It may be uncomfortable, like it's fine that it's uncomfortable, but the feeling and the sensation itself cannot harm you. What harms you is the story that you create about the feeling or the sensation that you then ruminate on or catastrophize about or overthink about or, go on whoever's health website at 1:30 in the morning and order their detox protocol because they promised you that it would make you better or like whatever else, right? Like that's the stuff that harms you. What you're feeling doesn't actually harm you. It's what you do trying to fix it that's harmful. So you suffer when you judge yourself for feelings or when you judge the feelings themselves. When you try to get rid of sensation, because when you're trying to get rid of something, you have basically said, I have judged this to be bad, or I have judged this to be unnecessary. Therefore, I need to get rid of it. When you're just feeling, you're present, just present. I'm repeating myself a lot because I want it to go into your subconscious very, very deeply. You can also have awareness and this level of presence with the voice in your head, your thoughts, right? So we just talked about somatic awareness. Now we can talk about cognitive awareness. You are not your thoughts. You can't be your thoughts if you can observe your thoughts. So you are a being. You are aware and present. You're a human being. Your body is going to experience feelings and sensations. Your only job is to notice curiously. You can make decisions after that, but your first job is to notice curiously. Your mind is also going to think and think and think. Russ Kennedy, the author of The Anxiety Rx, he says the mind is a meaning-making machine. Like, that's all it's ever going to do is think. And it will come up with the most preposterous, random, out of this world shit that you've ever, I mean, I'm sure you've all experienced it. Your mind can think of really crazy shit. And when you react to it, it usually creates a problem. We have to start learning how to notice it and be curious about it. Okay, that is the first half of our workshop slide part over. Let's do 5 minutes. So let's come back at 18 after. And we will continue from there.